All right, make sure you're in fellowship as we continue here. In verses 7 through 12, Genesis 10, looking at the genealogy from Cush, his sons, Seba, Havilah, Sabtah, Ramah, Sabtekah, and then grandsons from Ramah, Sheba, and Dedan. In verse 8, then we had the most infamous or famous son of notoriety that came from Cush, and that is in the person of Nimrod. Nimrod, the name itself means rebel or rebellion. He is the founder of the Tower of Babel situation and incident that is recorded for us in chapter 11. He is also the from which the origination of the mother-son occult came forth, which Roman Catholicism adopted, intermixing Christianity, the thought of Christianity, with the pagan idea in regards to Nimrod, which centers on the new birth via his son Tammuz, the Yule log, the Christmas tree, all these things find and giving a gift, find their origination all the way back in history in regards to this particular person. But for the sake of context, the emphasis on his person is his rise to power and being a founder of the first civilization in conjunction with his father Cush, the Mesopotamian regime as we know and understand it in early history. Two different aspects in regards to his person are brought out in his rise and becoming of power. And that is that he was a mighty warrior. He used naked aggression in order to subdue other humans, bring them under his control, etc. And that he also was a mighty hunter in the most superlative degree, as even recognized by God, being the subject of a proverb that has floated ever since, as it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. His hunting is in the form of, in regards to the extent of it, the power of it, is in the form of big game. And his big game, over and beyond what we would recognize and appreciate for today. Big game hunters, as we understand it, hunt rhinoceros, elephants, things of this nature, bear, etc. But his big game hunting included the aspect that he lived during the time that the dinosaurs were still a part of the environment and creation on this planet, as seen in the book of Job. And that's where we left off, page 12.18 of our notes. Job, having lived in the era between the flood and Abraham, gives apt descriptions as to the size and ferocity of some of these animals that he was able to take down, hunt, etc., in his prowess. In Job 40, under the description of Behemoth, verses 15 through 24, we note, and we looked at some of this back in the creation restoration scenario. Behold now, Behemoth, the pathetic attempts of trying to translate these things, such as a hippopotamus or whatever, doesn't float Now, these are dinosaurs as we would understand them, the huge ones, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. He's not carnivorous. Behold, now his strength in his loins. The power of this animal is almost beyond comprehension. His power in the muscles of his belly, large belly area. He bends his tail like a cedar, like a tree, a cedar tree, which cedar trees are known to be some of the biggest trees on the planet. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. It is not what you'll be gnawing on for the marrow. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play there. Under lotus plants he lies down, in the covert of the reeds and the marsh. The lotus plants cover him with shade. The willows of the brook surround him. If a river rages, he is not alarmed. The force of water, we obviously fully understand. Even a small stream, like a mountain stream or whatever, with a strong current, is often very difficult to ford. And imagine a raging river, uprooting trees, huge trees, things of this nature. He is confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth, all the way up to his head. The water can be that deep. This animal is so massive, so much weight, under that kind of force and pressure, he could still ford that river. Can anyone capture him when he is on watch? With barbs, can anyone pierce his nose? Can anyone tame him, domesticate it, if you will, bring it under control? And that is the challenge. And that is obviously one animal that Nimrod would be privy to and face and be able to put in his trophy case, if you will, in regards to being a mighty hunter. And obviously, to add to it, the style of hunting does not include the modern weaponry that we would be familiar with today. Spears, bows and arrows, ingenuity, traps, things of this nature. He didn't have no 458 caliber Winchester, Magnum, 460 Weatherby, 577 Nitro Express, 585 Garinger, or any other 600 caliber weapon to stop these things. I looked this stuff up. These are big game weapons, you know, designed to stop an elephant. Whether it even could, might be questionable. No, this man was able to hunt these things down using the weaponry of his time. The next one that we have here is under the term of Leviathan, and obviously it is also used with respect to the great serpent Satan. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? So this creature is able to survive in the water, is aquatic in this respect, or press down his tongue with a cord. Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many supplications to you? Or will he speak to you soft words? Now, this animal is extremely aggressive. Will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him for a servant forever? And obviously, it extends beyond regards to the type that might be associated with Satan otherwise. But there is a real animal that existed that basically had these characteristics. Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you bind him for your maidens? Will the traders bargain over him? Will they divide him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. He'll kill you. Obviously, closest thing we can probably think of is whale hunting in the old days, using harpoons and things of this nature. The big remake of Moby Dick's out there again, and all this other stuff. You know, but this one makes Moby Dick probably look like a minnow, at least in regards to his aggression. Behold, your expectation, verse 9, is false. Will you be laid low even at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. This animal, you let a sleeping dog lie, if you will. See, you don't want to provoke, even gain his attention. Verse 10b, who then is he that can stand before me? And obviously compared to God, that's still nothing. Who has given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silent concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his orderly frame. Who can strip off his outer garment? Who can come up with his double mail, his covering? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth there is terror. His strong scales are his pride, shut up as with a tight seal. One is so near to another that no air could come between them. The armor protecting the animal is unbelievable. Now, obviously, we get glimpses of how you would describe a dragon in our mythology. They are joined one to another. Verse 17, they clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezes flash forth light. And his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. And while one may think, well, this is just a supernatural myth in regard to that, this isn't possible, one needs to only do a slight study and understand that there are animals that have the ability to produce fire from their bodies. The example is the bombardier beetle. They're created with two different types of gases with an inhibitor inserted in their bodies. And when they spew out their gases without the inhibitor, it throws out fire. The inhibitor protects the beetle from its body. That's a self-defense mechanism. All we're doing is talking about the same construction, more or less, on a larger scale. See? So, you know, that, well, we always like to use that one for the evolutionists. Well, how many attempts did this one take to evolve? Because one gas or together, without an inhibitor, first and foremost, the beetle would blow up. You know, and it would die otherwise. All three of these things had to be put in place exactly at the same time in its proper form for this animal to even exist. So anyway, here we have a huge animal that finds its home in the oceans that can do these things. Verse 20, out of his nostrils smoke goes forth as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals and a flame goes forth from his mouth. In his neck lodges strength and dismay leaps before him. The folds of the flesh are joined together firm on him and immovable. His heart is hard as a stone, even as hard as lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty fear causes the crashing. They are bewildered. Just raises all kinds of hell when he moves around. Anything gets in his way. You hear this animal coming. You're booking it. You're wishing, when are they going to invent those bomb shelters so I can protect myself? You know, that type of deal. The sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. So obviously, a different mode of capture or killing would have to be put in place. This looks at the intrigue or the scientific development of Nimrod and his abilities to hunt. He regards iron as straw, bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned into stubble for him. Clubs are regarded as stubble. He laughs at the rattling of the javelin. His underparts are like the sharp posh herds. He spreads out like a threshing sledge on the mire. He makes the depths boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a jar of ointment. Behind him, he makes a wake to shine. One with the speed, even going through water. One would think the deep to be gray-haired. Nothing on earth is like him. One made without fear. He looks on everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. Anyone may have pride otherwise. This is one animal that people just didn't want to jack with. So, but yet, this is a kind of big game that was before Nimrod. And we can safely assume that somehow, some way, he is able to capture and kill even these most ferocious of animals. That's one bad dude, you ask me. So now, that gives you a picture of the very presence of this individual as he would be a part of the human race. And its capabilities, and why, indeed, the proverb, like a mighty hunter before the Lord, is attached to this person's name. So 19 creatures that instilled general panic and fear among man, Nimrod hunted down and killed. There are really no true adrenaline junkies compared to this guy. His adrenaline must have really needed satiating bad to become involved in that regards. 20, obviously his abilities and fearless aggression made him an exceptional opponent to anything he determined to subdue. 11, all other serious big game hunters would covet the accolade, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. They had that reputation also ascribed to another person, put you in the top of the line, the one percenters, if not more or less, however it may be. So 22, Nimrod's reputation preceded him and offered opportunity for him to organize society and rise to power. One of this caliber of ability, capabilities, ruthlessness, raw aggression, strength. He essentially was almost, if you will, unstoppable, even though eventually he was. So 22, Nimrod's reputation preceded him and offered opportunity for him to organize society and rise to power. He is also highly motivated, obviously, to develop this many cities in his time and this empire. 23, the main or, quote, chief centers, end quote, of his developed empire listed for us here in verse 10. 24, the noun, the beginning of, Reshaith, means head, chief, or first. 25, the noun kingdom, Mamaleka, emphasizes his sovereignty or absolute rule over his empire. Twenty-six. Now the first city, Babel, of quote Babylon, end quote, one and the same, is located on the Euphrates, south of where the Euphrates and Tigris River system approach in modern Iraq. The town, at least in name, still exists today. Still exists today. And most of us are fairly privy to it based on recent history with Iraq. So 27, Erech, the next one, is modern Warka. It's one of their main banks, is the Warka Bank in Iraq. The site in southern Iraq where archaeologists situate the birth of the first civilization. Right here in this area, they find archaeologists, even cosmic, say this is where civilization began, in this area. And it's also called Sumer, the land of Shinar, in the Hebrew, in our phrase. 28, Akkad's location is unknown at present. Some of these have simply just disappeared over time, covered by the earth, etc., have not been rediscovered, lost in history. 29. It was home of the famous Assyrian king Sargon. There still is connection, history associated with it that we're aware of. So 30, Kalna, the next one, is also unidentified and unknown. 31, Shinar, is the same as the Greek Mesopotamia and refers to the entire region, the combined area. 32, Nimrod's father Cush resided, quote, in the land of Shinar, end quote. 33, it is suggested that the Sumerian city Kish, K-I-S-H, which is a name appearing in clay tablets, was named after the Hebrew Cush. Not all archaeologists agree with that, but theologians that are up to speed see this similarity, and it all fits. 34, the early post-Diluvian Sumerian king lists affirmed that, quote, kingship descended from heaven to Kish, end quote, after the great flood. 35, the Hebrew name Cush later moved to present-day Ethiopia as migrations took place to other lands from Mesopotamia. So they migrated further south to where present Ethiopia is today, basically in Southeast Africa. 36, now the Sumerians the Hebrew name Cush later moved to present-day Ethiopia as migrations took place to other lands from Mesopotamia. 36, the Sumerians very early developed a religio-political state that was extremely binding on all that lived in it, excepting the rulers that were a law unto themselves. 37, this system was to influence the ancient Near East for over 3,000 years. Recorded history shows this, validates this. 38, other cultures following the Sumerian system were Akkad, the Babylonian Empire, Assyria, and Persia. 39, to have a position of, quote, kingship, end quote, is to have the authority to rule handed down by the gods. This is how kingship came into existence, as a form of political domination and rule. Kings. It is not anything that is sponsored by God per se in that respect. That's point 41 or 40, point 41st. The means to gaining absolute authority in the Near East was by force or subterfuge, or a combination of both, which is the most usual method. One would either have good military power or whatever, and use of intrigue, deceit, things of this nature to bring about the control of people. And a lot of times, and I would venture to say, if not most of times, a lot of this is psychological. All you got to do is look around our society and see the effects of psychology on people. Put people under fear. Next thing you know, give government control. Take away our rights. Protect us. See, rather than stand up and protect themselves. But anyway. It's so easy to get off on this anymore. But that's part of living in Babylon in the last days. We get first-hand experience. So other major empires, regimes, practiced this type of government as it originated through this Mesopotamian or Sumer civilization. And to have that position deified, if you will, or at least connected the individual, appointed king or made king, as having a direct contact with God. So 41, kingship did not evolve. It wasn't just something that basically came forth through a series of trials and error. It was developed and instituted, and as we see here, right off the bat, in regards to the person of Nimrod being the premier example. So kingship did not evolve, rather it is fabricated, usually by a group of priest nobles that supported one man in power. And then they would do what was necessary, politically, militarily, propaganda, otherwise, to promote their agenda. 42, clever men manipulated the populace's religious instincts to cause them to follow and obey the local god's son. That is to the example of the ruler. He is the son of God. 43, he owned the people and the land, in theory at least. Forty-four, when the literature and monuments were used to glorify and exalt this man as the son or representative of God, religion then became the opiate, the binder and the blinder of the people. The danger inherent in religiosity, the mysticism that religiosity utilizes to bring about control over others. Christianity, true Christianity, is not of such ilk. Obviously, it recognizes the supernatural. But the mysticism otherwise is removed in regards to the realities of Christianity and God's plan for man. As we have seen, it is based on the literal, factual things that occur in the history of man and with people. It tells you like it is. See. The people become religious. They start pursuing their own agenda in their negative volition, rejecting the truth of Bible doctrine. And they then will ultimately find themselves in a cult, not a cult, a cult of mysticism, of which they then will be controlled by those who are the heads and organizers of these religions otherwise. 42. So that's part of the judgment. If you reject the truth, you will fill the vacuum with another type of religious ideology or philosophy to replace, if one wants, the word religion. But it's still a religion because it governs their thinking. There's all kinds of religion. Religion doesn't mean you have to have Jesus or the name God involved in it, but the principle still remains. A God still exists, even though they may call it Mother Nature. See, the environment, things of this nature. Doctrine frees you from that. You're going to have some form, frame of reference, and thinking that's going to guide and lead and direct you in life. You have light, you have darkness. Religiosity appeals to the darkness. And again, often you have a great mixture of both. And even within the pagan religiosity, you still see even the core truth that's involved in regards to their practices, such as sacrifice, mother-son cult, things of this nature. And people like to project what was here first, what religion was here first. The truth was here first. Religion spawned from that. The best religion can do is imitate the truth in some form or fashion and twist it into their own design. Kings came about through the control, religious control of people, of buying in to the substitutes, to the truth of God's plan for the world. Whatever ideology that the person may otherwise propose. So 45, there are three principles basic to the function of, quote, divine, end quote, kingship in the ancient Near East. 46, they are essential to using religion for political control. Doesn't take much to do a background check on that now, does it? To use religion for political control. See, again, the wisdom behind local churches, just to stay aloof from this stuff. Yeah. Oh. It doesn't bother us if you want to maintain your tax deductible status or whatever, that you don't support political parties. Well, I wouldn't want to do that anyway. See, that's not why we're here. We're here to provide you with the truth, so that you don't fall into all this religious BS otherwise, or other modes of religiosity as it may exist. So three basic principles in the function of divine kingship. Even the Jews, God did not establish the Jews originally in regards to their government with a king. That came about from their moaning and groaning and whining, wanting to be like all the rest of the nations. And they took what they saw in that regard and they put it in as perspective of worship of true God. See, and judges is how God authorized the government of Israel to begin with. Through a series of judges, just take care of matters in court, if you will. And these often would have, obviously, the gifts of prophecy, etc., so that those things could be handled in accurate manners. But, and then, obviously, God takes the situation and He utilizes it for His own good and produces the King of Kings. That's what the world wants, that's what you'll get. Forty-seven. The king is divine, from which the beginning of written history. The Sumerians see the kings as divine in the Sumerian king list. The recording of that—that's what is brought out. 48. Hokkart in kingship says, "Quote: the earliest known religion is a belief in the divinity of kings." I do not say that it is necessarily the most primitive, but in the earliest records known, man appears to us worshiping gods and their representatives, namely kings. So 49, first and foremost, to make the control effective, the person at the top has to assume divinity or semi-divinity, to be deified in some form or fashion. So 50, the second is that the king is above the laws, and he makes changes to it as he pleases, as he gets his orders direct from, quote, heaven. People that strive for these positions, megalomaniacs, if you will, have unquenchable powerless things of this nature, and they utilize and try to set themselves up above the law. The true King of Kings is fulfillment of the law. So even he's not set above the law, if you will. Uh, 51, in the third, and he gets his orders direct from heaven. 51, the third important item is documents supporting their right to rule. It's got to make it legal. 52, the epic literature of the Near East, we read that the hero has been chosen to rule. Personality cult. See, that's another cult. People make their sacred cows from personalities. People's accomplishments, things of this nature. 53, actually the literary texts and monuments were fabricated to create this impression on the populace. Supernatural feats otherwise were attached to their reputations, things of this nature. 54, early man was not unintelligent, but without God he was unscrupulous. That's another misnomer, alignment in regards to humanity living centuries before us, that somehow they were more stupid than us. They were not as intelligent as we are. There's nothing further from the truth. Just because they hadn't come across certain inventions, etc., that maybe we have in our point in time after centuries of people working on things, etc., and find things click and come into place, doesn't mean they were any less intelligent. Solomon was one smart dude. You do well to be the genius character in regards to this individual. The intellectual capabilities. But that's the way the evolutionists like to tamp down the historical accuracy of the Bible and how, you know, try to discolor people that religion is just this thing for unintelligent, stupid people. And they just gravitate towards it for its mysticism and things of this nature. Whatever. 55, the elite deceived the working serfs and kept them in their place. 56, they were not taught to read and write. To keep them uneducated, keeping them in their menial tasks, etc., separating out the people that are intelligent and giving them all the opportunities otherwise that they may gravitate towards, things of this nature, but the rest, the mass population, you know, keep them in the technical institutes. Don't let them go on to college and get a degree. A lot of this stuff that we're seeing in our educational system and how it's all evolved through the modern system of education, nothing new under the sun. Just another way to try to control the masses. But anyway. Fifty-seven. Most literature is found in the palace temple complex of ancient cities. You didn't find them in common homes and things that are dug up in the diggings, architectural diggings and things of that nature. 58. The shadowy mist and legend of the ancient Near East are deliberately shadowy to make certain things gray. A form of deceit to make people look supernatural in and of themselves. So. 59, they were fabricated originally, copied, and in successive societies revised and reused to retain control. The idea worked. And is perpetuated throughout history, different societies, etc. It's just a remake, different ways, packaged in different ways. 60 in verses 8 through 11, we learn that Nimrod then established a kingdom. Uh, 61, we would expect perhaps to find such a man as Nimrod in the archaeological record, concerning the fact that there are flood stories in these records. The flood stories have existed through ancient writings, and yet the smart geniuses of our time continue to deny it. The hypocrisy, the stupidity is almost laughable. So you expect, obviously, that there we should find some parallel somewhere in regards to someone of such notoriety as it would exist in this respect. And that goes back to Sumerians, the area of Mesopotamia, and their civilization. 62, in addition to the Sumerians, the Babylonians wrote about this person, the Syrians likewise, and the Hittites. It's just a matter of decoding and put together two and two to see this. 63, even in Palestine, tablets have been found with this hero's name on them. 64, the prime candidate for this literature is Gilgamesh, which a poem is written concerning this individual, and as we'll see, he fits the Nimrod character and the situation basically across the board. And I'm going to head and just, we'll stop here before I get in the middle of this and we have to knock it off. Come back Tuesday and we'll finish the story for you. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to light these things in Jesus' name. Amen.